The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Alejandro Gacartigas. I'm the CEO and founder of Springboard Collaborative, a Philly-based education startup featured in A Path Appears, and I have the honor of introducing Nick Kristoff. Nick's resume is as impressive as they come. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard and then studied law as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, where he graduated with first-class honors. In high school, Nick caught the travel bug, the first in a series of insect-borne illnesses he's contracted abroad. Nick has lived on 4 continents, reported on 6, and traveled to more than 140 countries. In 1990, Nick and his wife Cheryl became the first married couple to win the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, recognized for their coverage of China's Tiananmen Square democracy movement. Nick won a second Pulitzer in 2006 for what the judges called, and I quote, his graphic, deeply reported columns that, at personal risk, focused attention on genocide in Darfur and gave voice to the voiceless in other parts of the world. Nick is often hailed and celebrated for his voice, but I think the true genius of Nicholas Kristoff is actually in his ears. Nick hears the voices the rest of the world has tuned out, and he uses his craft to help us listen to them as well. In doing so, he has become one of the world's great teachers of empathy, binding us closer together with every word that he writes. Nick's latest lesson comes in A Path Appears, a book he co-wrote with Cheryl. For the visual learners among you, there's a PBS documentary version of the book that will be airing in January. Booklist writes of A Path Appears, Nick and Cheryl's vibrant portraits of ordinary citizens who are motivated to effect real and dramatic change present a rallying call to action and a voice for the power of volunteerism. This is a slow-go read in the most positive sense. It is hard not to constantly put down the book in order to further investigate the many exemplary causes that are profiled. I am deeply humbled that Nick and Cheryl chose Springboard as one among these exemplary causes. Nick and I cross paths because we both hear a voice our nation has ignored, that of low-income parents who have largely been excluded from the process of educating their children. Through A Path Appears, Nick elevates their voices to our collective conscience in the way that only he can. So let's show Nick some brotherly love and please welcome him to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks a lot, and it really is a privilege to be here and also to be introduced by a star in the book. How many of you know about Springboard Collaborative? Okay, Philadelphia, you got to learn more about it. This guy's a star, and his model, I would bet, is going to be expanding around the country. Yeah, let's give Alejandro a round. What happened was that Alejandro was a Teach for America teacher here, and he was so proud of how he was changing these kids' lives and teaching them so much. And he was a believer in metrics and testing, so in the fall, he tested his kids to see, you know, how many grades they had jumped at that point. And he was crushed to discover they were still behind where they had tested at the end of the previous school year because of the summer slide. And so that led him to think more about the summer slide. And, you know, the fact is, of course, that middle-class kids get all kinds of enrichment activities and are dragged from music classes to soccer lessons to chess, et cetera, et cetera. And low-income kids are just kind of, you know, being pulled back. And so we started this summer program here in Philadelphia for these at-risk kids that has turned a three-month decline in reading scores over the summer to a 3-month gain. And and it seems as if about half of the rich-poor performance gap in high school students, that maybe half of that is attributable to summer cumulative summer slides. So it's, you know, one way of addressing. There are no silver bullets in the world, but there are kind of silver buckshot, and this is one of those bits of buckshot that I hope is going to spread. So if you're interested, you know, find Alejandro afterward, and you can talk to him more about it. I should say that, let's see if I can make this go forward. Well, maybe not. Here we go. Cheryl, my wife and co-author, sends her regrets. We're not traveling together on the book tour because we still have our baby as a high school senior. And if we traveled together, she would have the most amazing parties, you know? So Cheryl sends her regrets. For those who wonder about the title, there it is. Isn't that interesting? It comes from a Chinese writer, Lu Xun, that hope is like a path in the countryside. Originally, there is nothing, and then as people walk this way again and again, a path appears. And isn't that a nice saying? You know, it appealed to us both because it seemed to us that there really is an evidence base emerging more and more about how to make a difference, and also because one of those clues about what makes a difference is hope. As Alejandro mentioned, this is going to be a PBS documentary beginning in late January. How many of you saw the PBS documentary of Half the Sky before? Well, this one is going to be, from my biased point of view, every bit as good. And let me see if I can show you a trailer. No? Anybody want to buy anything on Amazon? It's a good thing that I didn't entitle our book "A Video Appears." My credibility would be undermined.
Our new project is called "A Path Appears." The title is from Lu Xun, a prominent Chinese writer, who said that hope is like a path in the countryside. At first, there is no path, but as more and more people walk again and again, a path appears, meaning a solution appears. It's about innovative strategies for making a difference.
It's not just a project, it's a movement. We want in this effort to go beyond Half the Sky.
In Half the Sky, we were asking, how do you begin to tackle seemingly insurmountable problems?
Is that red door, is that a ruffle, I think?
Yes, it is.
She doesn't have a radial pulse. Stay safe, okay?
In A Path Appears, we take it to a new level. We actually look at the roots of vulnerability, and we talk about solutions that really address those roots.
It's easier to look at problems outside the country than it is to look at stuff in our own backyard.
More than 300,000 girls go missing each year.
In the United States?
In the U.S., and 100,000 of them are sold for sex in some form.
Nick and Cheryl use stories to capture attention.
Police, you're under arrest, okay?
That's not the reality. This is the reality.
Did you rape Flavian?
I didn't.
And you did not lock her up in her room?
To break through the resistance or the indifference?
Like every day.
Because stories are powerful.
That's her.
That's her?
That's Naomi.
I know it's devastating, but this really, this is going to be the way to get her back. Hopefully we'll see her tonight. So stay tuned, PBS in January. There were a couple of reasons why we ended up moving from Half the Sky to A Path Appears. One is that when we were talking about Half the Sky, that people would invariably come up to us and ask, what can I do? And I think there's so many people who feel this yearning to have an impact, to connect with a cause larger than themselves, partly maybe to model behavior to their kids, but they don't really know what to do, and they're often suspicious of corruption, of inefficiency, of whether anybody actually can make a difference. And our response is that, look, helping people is hard. There are a lot of things that can go wrong, but there are indeed ways that one can have a profound impact for very modest sums of money, or indeed no money at all, through advocacy or volunteering. This is an example. People are always also surprised that for somebody like me who, you know, I cover genocide and global poverty and sex trafficking, that I'm in many ways kind of an optimist about the world. And that's partly because of the progress that I've seen and the chances to make a difference that I've witnessed. One of the things when I first traveled around Africa as a backpacking law student many years ago, the thing that really maybe I found most dispiriting was the blindness. And one of the most painful ways to go blind is from trachoma, a bacterial infection. This woman had it in Mali, in West Africa, and she described it as like the pain of childbirth, but every hour, day in, day out, year in, year out. Because she was blind, she was unable to farm her field, and several of her children died. So it's much more than just the blindness for one person or the pain. And then we saw a $40 surgery from this nurse beside her, $40 surgery that gave her eyesight back, and through a group called Helen Keller International. And she, you know, you witness that, and she, after the surgery, somebody is helping her and saying, you know, you want me to help you out? And she says, get out of my way. I can see now. I can look after myself. And, you know, that is just so inspiring and uplifting. And the fact that you can do that, accomplish that, transform her life and her family's life for $40 is just kind of an extraordinary privilege. And so I don't want to guilt trip you. I want to, you know, talk about this as an opportunity in a sense. And likewise, there is more of an evidence base about what works and what doesn't work than there ever was before. For example, we talk about the importance of education. I think education is the intervention that I care about most globally, perhaps. And we always think about building schools as the natural way of doing that. And that is indeed one way. But, you know, we have better metrics now. It costs several hundred dollars if you use bricks and mortar to get one more marginal student in school. If you do it by subsidizing school uniforms, you can get one more kid in school for $100. But the cheapest way of getting one more marginal kid in school is actually to deworm kids. And we don't think about that because our kids in this country don't have intestinal parasites. In much of the developing world, they do. They're more likely to be sick, to be anemic, have difficulty concentrating on their schoolwork, and they can be dewormed with a simple pill that once or twice a year that transforms their ability to study. So there are these kinds of innovations that we're learning more about, and we wanted to introduce them to people. We hope that people, after reading A Path Appears, won't just put down the book and start another book, but will actually get engaged in some of the issues that we talk about, whether it's Alejandro's or something half a world away, whether abroad or at home. And one of the things that to us was most reassuring was on Friday, I was walking down 42nd Street in New York, and a man stopped me, and he said, you know, Nick Kristoff, and I'm always a little nervous that it's somebody who disagrees with me about, you know, gun policy or something. But no, it turned out that he was actually the audio engineer who had recorded the audio book for A Path Appears, and he'd listened to this being recorded and then spliced it all together, and he decided he really wanted to do something. He wanted to give back, and he thought, well, what are my skills? It's audio recording. And so he is starting a project to record children's stories for families that don't read to their kids or that don't even have a school book at home, distributed through nursery schools or Head Start or programs like that. And it seems to us that there are so many people out there who would like to find a way of making a difference. And, you know, we hope, and there's so many needs out there, that we hope that this will help bridge some of that gap. The And this doesn't have to be kind of a formal organization, a formal activity. A lot of it is just kind of empathy and taking risks on people. We tell the story in the book of this man, Ollie Neal, who grew up in rural Arkansas, went to a segregated school in the late 1950s, and was kind of a troublemaker. He was mouthing off to his teachers. He made the school librarian, Mrs. Grady, cry. He shoplifted and was fired from his job. He just really seemed to be heading for a trajectory of trouble. And then one day he skips class and goes to the school library where Mrs. Grady has set up this small little library. And he sees this book on the shelf, this novel by an African-American author, Frank Yerby. And it's got a cover that it has this woman in kind of a risque outfit. At least risque by 1957 standards, which probably means she was incredibly well-dressed. So he thought that was kind of interesting, and he looked through it, and he thought, well, he'd kind of like to try reading it, but he was a tough kid, and it would have been way too embarrassing for a tough kid to actually check out a book. And so he stole it. He just put it under his jacket and walked out. And he read it at home and really loved it. And he was sort of awoken to the joy of reading. And so a week or so later, he sneaked it back in the library, put it back on the shelf, and he noticed that there was another book by Frank Yerby also. So he stole that one. And again, just a terrific novel. It got him excited. He returns it and sees there's a book by Frank Yerby that he hadn't noticed either of the previous two times. So he takes that too. And this happens four times. And then by that point, he's really kind of turned on to reading. He begins to read a lot of other stuff, more serious literature, current affairs. He ends up going to college. He ends up, after that, going to law school, becomes one of Arkansas's first African-American lawyers, becomes a leader in the civil rights movement, and eventually a prosecutor and a judge. This is the swearing-in, his swearing-in as a judge. And so he's a hero to this school that he attended. And so he goes back to reunions. And at one of these reunions, he tells Mrs. Grady, you know, it was your little library that really turned me around. But I have to confess that it turned me around because I stole some of your books. And she said, well, actually, I have a confession too. It turned out that she had seen him steal that first book. And she had been about to confront him. She was angry, you know, why are you stealing a book when you can just check it out? But then in a flash of insight, she had understood that maybe he was embarrassed to be seen checking out a book. And so she let him steal it. And then in hopes that this kid would actually be turned on to reading, would like it, she then that weekend drove 70 miles to Memphis to the used bookstores there. The first used bookstore she went to didn't have anything by Frank Yerby. She went to another. Finally, I think it was the third one that did. With her own money, she bought a Frank Yerby novel, put it back in the shelf, and she was thrilled when he stole that second book. So she went back to Memphis, repeated this four times this happened, and it turned his life completely around. And to me, it's just a reminder that sometimes it's important just to take risks on people, and they don't pan out. And I've certainly had my heart broken plenty of times from trying to help people. But sometimes you can get through and have this incredible impact, whether through a formal organization or some other context. This also kind of relates to the other reason why Cheryl and I wanted to write A Path Appears, which has to do with inequality in this country. We all know, you know, some of the statistics, but beyond the economic inequality or the income inequality or the wealth inequality, we also, I think, know instinctively that there's an even greater gap in inequality of opportunity. And when in some zip codes a boy of color is more likely to end up in prison than in college, then this is something that should leave us profoundly unsettled. Some people showed an image. They asked people to choose between two different distributions, the blue and the red, and So 92% said they preferred Sweden's distribution of wealth, which is the blue one. And I think more beyond that, there are ways we can see now to address inequality. And for us, one of the real lessons was the importance of intervening early. It seemed to us that the reason why more of our efforts over the last half century haven't accomplished more has been that we started too late. And there are a few reasons for that. This is the boy we write about in the book, Johnny. We met him in West Virginia. He has a disadvantaged background, and it turned out at age 3, with a Save the Children screening, that he had had ear infections and was deaf. And so for his first 3 years, he wasn't getting, as his brain was developing, he wasn't getting any of that auditory stimulation that the brain needs. And so at this point at age 3, when I met him, he still wasn't speaking. But the hearing problem was fairly easily corrected. But he had missed that window, and we still don't know whether he's ever going to be able to recover. And the idea that 50 or 60 years from now, Johnny will still not be able to live up to his potential because we let him slip through the cracks in the first couple of years of life, I just find heartrending. It's just, to me, one of the basic principles of life is that talent is universal, but opportunity is not. And Johnny reflects that perfectly. This also goes to one of the sort of awkward facts of life, which is that there's not only an income gap and a wealth gap and an opportunity gap, but also to some degree a parenting gap. And there is pretty abundant evidence that one of the pathways by which poverty replicates generation after generation has to do with children in disadvantaged backgrounds growing up under stress, and the body responds to that by producing a stress hormone called cortisol. And the cortisol is good for your brain for a brief period, but if your brain is constantly bathed in cortisol, it changes the actual structures of the brain. The prefrontal cortex, which is impulse control, doesn't develop as fully. The hippocampus is less symmetrical and smaller. And so you can actually see some of the impact on brain scans. We quote this neuroscientist, growing up poor is bad for your brain. And it has to do with this combination of a deficit of words and hugs. By age 4, a child of professionals has heard 30 million more words than a child on welfare. And there's also, middle-class families have more time, resources, better childcare options. Their child is getting hugged and supported a lot more positive reinforcement. A child growing up in a very stressful environment is getting somewhat less of that. And the one study found indeed that at age 3.5, maternal attachment to a child is a better predictor of high school graduation than IQ is. Now, the lesson that some people draw from that is, well, it's kind of hopeless, that some parents are just bad parents. And that's totally not the case. There, in fact, is pretty good evidence that nobody wants their child to grow up with a deficit of either hugs or words. But you raise kids largely the way you were raised and under all kinds of constraints. And so if one gets outside coaching, one can do a much better job talking to your child and providing emotional support to your child. One of the organizations that we talk about in the book is Nurse Family Partnership, started by this guy, David Olds. This is him way back when he was starting working with four-year-olds, disadvantaged four-year-olds, and he realized that at that point it was already almost too late. And so he started Nurse Family Partnership, beginning working with at-risk moms during pregnancy, and then continuing up to age 2. And the impact, and it's been incredibly carefully studied. with randomized controlled trials. And so one study found, for example, that state-verified child abuse happens 78% less often in the nurse family partnership kids. The kids who have been in it, even though they end the program at age 2, by age 15 they've been arrested only half as often. One study by the RAND Corporation found that for the most at-risk kids, every dollar invested in nurse family partnership brings almost $6 of economic return, because the kids are less likely to be incarcerated, the moms are much more likely to use family planning, and they're much less likely to need state support. And yet only 2 to 3% of the kids who need nurse family partnership interventions in this country, only 2 to 3% get it. And that's incredibly frustrating. I think there are also some folks here from nurse family partnership. I don't know if they're in this room or the overflow room. If you're in the overflow room, you're probably feeling pretty frustrated right now that you can't stand up. But anybody in this room? Okay. I think maybe they're in the overflow room. But just a great program, indeed, working here as in many other places around the country. I want to make sure we have time for questions, so let me just flash through some of this. There are a couple of ways in which we sometimes psych ourselves out, and one is the basic kind of notion of why should I care? And one of the basic answers to that is that if you see the people who need help, then you're much more likely to intervene. But one of the ways, one of the sort of odd facts about the U.S. is that the bottom 20% of incomes, people in the bottom 20%, actually donate more as a fraction of their incomes to charity than the top 20%. And I think that the reason is not that the top 20% are intrinsically less empathetic or less compassionate, but what it seems to be is that if you are wealthy, you live in kind of a isolated environment, and you're probably in a leafy suburb somewhere, and your friends are well off, and you don't encounter needs in your daily life. While if you are a lower socioeconomic level, all the time you're encountering people with even greater needs than yourself, and that leads you to be more generous and more compassionate. And but the other reason, aside from the difference with the impact one can have, is the selfish pleasures of altruism. And this was something that Cheryl and I explored. There's been a lot of correlations in the past studies that that altruism is more highly correlated to longevity than cholesterol levels, for example. One study looked at seniors and found that joining a church or other religious organization was associated with a 29% reduction in mortality rates. Exercising several times a week was associated with a 30% reduction in mortality. And volunteering for several organizations was associated with a 44% reduction. And you see where this is going. If you just volunteer for a religious running organization, you live forever. this sense has been confirmed with brain research, and Cheryl and I participated in an experiment that a scholar is doing where they look at the pleasure centers of the brain, and these are areas like the nucleus accumbens that light up when you flirt with somebody, when you eat nice food, when somebody compliments you, when you have sex. And also when you get a gift. And I think that's either Cheryl or me. I'm not sure whether one of us is in there. Having our brain scanned, we have this little goggles that are kind of a computer monitor so we can see things, and we have a clicker in each hand. And we, as our brain is being scanned, we are getting gifts, and they watch the pleasure centers light up. And we also are asked if we want to make a donation to an organization, including Helen Keller International, the one that does the trachoma work. And so they look at how they respond. And indeed, for about half of Americans, their pleasure centers light up as much or more when they give as when they get. So there's a real primal pleasure associated with trying to give back. And I think also in kind of a chaotic and, you know, difficult world, it's a way of providing a certain moral order, a certain reassurance in the world. This is a girl we write about, Rachel Beckwith. Maybe some of you remember her story. She was a little girl in Seattle who had at her church, she had heard about a group called Charity Water and about the idea that so many people don't have clean water around the world. So she donated her 9th birthday to, in lieu of gifts, she asked for donations on her little page on Charity Water to donate to build a well. And she set her goals. She wanted to raise $300. She was kind of disappointed that in the end she'd only raised $220. And then shortly after her birthday, she was in a very serious car accident. She was critically injured. Her family, friends, relatives, community, they wanted to show support for this little girl in a coma in the hospital. And so they thought of her page, and they began donating to her Charity Water page. And the amount soared past her goal, soared past 1,000. As she's in a coma, her parents are whispering to her, not knowing if she can hear or not, that she has set a new record on Charity Water for a birthday by beating Justin Bieber's birthday record. And it keeps on going from there. And she dies. But people, moved by what this little girl has done. They donate a total of $1.2 million in Rachel's memory. And obviously, there's nothing that can salve the loss of a child like that. But it did, I think, for the family, the fact that they were able to provide water, clean water, for 37,000 people in Rachel's memory. I think it did help. This is a well in Ethiopia, that it did provide some kind of reassurance, some kind of way of commemorating an extraordinary life. And, that is ultimately available, I think, to all of us. And maybe I'll just leave you with another story that has to do with that. This is Kibera School for Girls, which in Kenya, which is an amazing place. And I think there's some high school students in the overflow room who have not in the overflow room. There you are. Okay. So I think you have some relationship with a school in Kibera. Is it with the Kibera School for Girls? Okay. Well, if you want to find out more about that, then afterward, to chat with her. People ask about sort of how I became engaged in this, or my kind of the source of my optimism, and why I kind of think that adding a drop in the bucket is really meaningful. And part of it is that something I write about in the book that I haven't talked a lot about before, and my dad was a World War II refugee. He fled Romania. He ended up in a concentration camp in Yugoslavia. Eventually, he made his way to Paris, and he was cleaning hotel rooms in Paris, and there was a young woman from Portland, Oregon, who was working in Paris, and he happened to be cleaning her hotel room every day, and so they got to know each other, and she really liked him, thought he was, smart, wonderful. And so she convinced her parents back in Portland, who had never met him, of course, that they should sponsor his way to come to the U.S. And they did so, and they got their church, the First Presbyterian Church in Portland, to do so as well, even though he was Catholic. And they took a risk. Might not have worked out. And it obviously didn't solve the global refugee problem. But for my dad, it was transformative, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that. And so I think in the same way, we're not going to solve the global education problem, the global literacy problem, the global malaria problem. But it is within our capacity for any of us to really have a transformative impact on some particular people, whether it's the girls you're helping in Kibera, whether it's people with bed nets, whether it's the kids that Alejandro is working with right here in Philadelphia. And, that's ultimately, I think, what I am trying to pay it forward, and I hope that you will too. And I'd love to take questions. Thank you. There are two mics going around, so if you want to ask a question, just raise your hand and just spot one of the people with a mic.
I'm sure I'm not the only person that you've been a mentor to from afar.
I appreciate that.
I'm Susan Martell, and you're, I'm sure, aware of the UNICEF report card 11, which came out last April, which says that it determines that the U.S., when it comes to the welfare of our children, is 26th of 29 major countries. This blew my mind, and this report speaks to the issues that you talk about, hunger, health care, education, and so forth. I felt I had to do something, so I started Campaign 26 of 29 to make the world aware of the world, to make people that I come in contact with aware of this. It seems that people who vote, our legislators who vote for children's benefits, pretty much split along party lines. And I can't help but feel a little jaundiced about this. I realize that in 2035, the population of the U.S. will no longer be all Caucasian.
Let me comment on that, and just so we get...
Yes, excuse me for taking up so much time. Well, how can you speak to this?
Sure. I think one big frustration of mine is that the U.S. really pioneered mass education. We were the first country to have close to universal literacy. We were the first country to have many, many high schools and to send many people to college. And until about 1970, we were peerless in that. Now, we still have the world's best universities, but by every other metric, since the 1970s, we've been kind of frozen. And if you look at mobility, at whether people have get more education than their parents did, then especially at the bottom end of the socioeconomic spectrum, only 20% of kids actually are getting more education than their parents did. And I think the related frustration is that we've reached for all the high-hanging fruit in all kinds of ways. So there are all kinds of incredibly expensive health interventions that we do phenomenally well. But Johnny's hearing screening doesn't get done for so many kids, and the result is catastrophe for a kid like that. And so those kids are voiceless. We have voices, and so we talk about some great advocacy organizations in the book, One Campaign, Results.org, that we tend to think about making a difference in terms of writing checks. There are also incredibly powerful ways to make a difference through volunteering or advocacy.
I have two questions. You can pick either or.
I'll take the easy one.
In at least two of your columns, I read how you have taken a young person with you on some of your global trips to raise their awareness, to enlighten them as to what's going on in the rest of the world. So I wonder how you got started down that path and if you can elaborate a little bit upon it. And the other one is, I saw the documentary Half the Sky, and I wonder what results, the most important results that have emanated from that effort.
I was frustrated when I was covering Darfur, the Darfur genocide, about how to engage people. It felt like I was writing these columns and then they were sort of disappearing without a trace. And so I had the bright idea that I would take a college student with me to Darfur. We would report together and other students would be interested in a student's view of what they were seeing. And so, full of excitement and exuberance, I presented this idea within the New York Times. And the Times lawyers said, so you want to take a student into a war zone? Well, so then I recast it as taking a student on a trip to the developing world and writing about global poverty issues as a way of trying to highlight some of those. The joke within the New York Times is that first prize is one trip with me. Second prize is two trips with me. Because they are sometimes kind of difficult trips. In terms of the impact of the documentary, I think that, you know, partly we were pushing on an open door, so I don't want to claim credit. The issue of empowering women, the benefits you get from educating girls, seeing those educated women go into the formal labor force, this is something that there's been growing awareness of already. But I do think that we help push that door a little farther, a little more open, and maybe to some degree have helped break some of the taboos, that sexual violence happens in part because it's hard to talk about, and because there's impunity as a result. And I think to some degree we're helping chip away at that impunity here and abroad, and that will be the goal also of A Path Appears.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Kristoff. Thanks so much for coming here. I'm actually a big fan of yours, even whether I agree or disagree with whatever you write. I think it inspires a lot of thought, so thank you for that. The question I have is actually your experience with inspiring altruism in others, and I think our generation is kind of currently having a debate on, you know, what that should exactly mean, especially in light of movements like hashtag activism and, you know, the ice water bucket challenge and things like that. Do you think movements like that kind of hold us back and pacify us from, you know, really truly getting to know a cause, taking to the streets or visiting elected officials? Or do you see that as a bigger picture of people taking a first step? Thank you.
It always feels incumbent upon middle-aged people to complain about how awful young people are. but in fact, I'm kind of in awe of millennials and how engaged they've been in so many issues. And I think that your generation has also been kind of more shrewd about how to make a difference. My generation tended to address issues, but often in symbolic ways, or try to, find legal solutions that would solve a problem in its entirety. So, you know, our effort with education would be to pass some kind of a compact or resolution demanding that all girls get educated. And I think those, you know, there is a role for those initiatives, but I think your generation has been more inclined to sponsor a particular class in a particular school in a particular refugee camp somewhere. And over time, I think I've become a believer that that may be actually the way that doesn't solve the global problem, but clearly has a real impact on real people. In terms of hashtag activism, I see it as kind of a gateway drug to greater engagement. And so, you know, if somebody can initially tweet something about bring back our girls, then I hope that that person will bit by bit but just become a little more aware that halfway around the world there are girls who are being attacked just because they dare to dream of becoming teachers or doctors or lawyers. And that awareness really is one step forward. It doesn't solve the problem. It's not a sufficient step for change, but it probably is a necessary one. So as long as people don't stop at signing an online petition or a Facebook post, then I think that it is part of the solution, and I hope, indeed, a precursor to greater involvement.
I have a question about a statement that you made in last Sunday's New York Times column. And I have a grave... I need your explanation to this statement. It says, just since 1968, it has been calculated more Americans have died from gunfire than have died in
all the wars in American history.
Right.
And
how is that? How I don't understand that.
Well, it's about a little more than 30,000 Americans die of gun violence a year. I forget the math. So over, so that's somewhat more than a million people dying of gun violence since 1968. And in all the wars of American history, the Congressional Research Service did a calculation of how many Americans had died. The Civil War obviously killed the most, more than 600,000. And all cumulative, it was maybe 50,000 or 100,000 less than have died in gun violence since 1968. That's the basis of the calculation.
My name is Brittany, and I serve with City Year here at South Philadelphia High School. I'm trying to promote an awareness of international social justice issues and empathy in my students. So I was wondering if you had any best practices for how any of us might be able to reach out to school-age students who might otherwise be apathetic to these issues.
You know, you probably have a, you're probably more of an expert on this, and probably the high school students who are here are even more experts on this. I'm kind of fascinated by the service requirements that so many high schools have imposed. And my take is that often students engage in service for somewhat cynical reasons, that they think it's going to help them get into college, or if they're in college, it'll help them win a fellowship or get into grad school. But that once you actually, even if your original instinct is that you're doing this for cynical reasons, that it actually does expose you to a certain amount of need, and it gets you out of your, you know, insulated, your world, and that it also maybe gives people a greater sense of perspective on their own good fortune, and some of the rewards of giving back. And so that even when it's purely cynical initially, that it does have some usefulness. And I think that also that empathy more broadly is one of the most fundamental gaps that we have in this country, and that so much else flows from that. I'm struck that whenever I write about problems of poverty or disadvantage in the U.S., and so many people push back and say, you know, damn it, if they only worked hard and, you know, did well in school and stayed out of trouble from the law, whatever, that, you know, everything would be just fine. And I think people, a lot of successful people in the U.S. think that their achievements are purely the result of their own great efforts, when, you know, most of us, frankly, were born on third base. And it's a lot harder to get home if you've been born on third base. Susan Fiske, a Princeton scholar, did a really troubling set of brain scans of successful people as they looked at images of people who were homeless or manifestly poor. And she found that the brain of successful people will process those images not as if they were people, but as if they were things. You're dehumanizing the poor in a way. And you know, that's a complex problem, how we address that. And I think part of it is storytelling, and that's why I try to tell a lot of stories in my column and in the books. And I do think that maybe school years are a time when one can address that and try to build a little empathy and understanding, and that may be indeed a crucial role for schools as they build the future citizens of the country.
Hi, I just graduated from Villanova University, and my question is about your opinion on the concept of voluntourism, because during my time at Villanova and in high school, I went on several mission trips both in the country and abroad. And I realized during those trips as I got older that the work we were doing and the houses we were building, the locals there were taking more time to teach us how to build these houses and correcting our mistakes. And if we hadn't been there, they probably could have built the house in a quarter of the time. So I was just wondering and what your opinion was on that, if it's better just to send money and have them do it, or if it's better to go and get... I mean, I feel like from going on these trips, I gained a better understanding of the world, and I'm more involved with nonprofits, and I know now that I know I'm not making a huge difference, and it probably would be better just for them to do it themselves, but I guess I'm just wondering what your opinion on these kinds of trips are.
Yeah, it was an interesting question. I periodically serve on road selection committees, and it always strikes me how many service... you know, trips on summers or whatever, how many service trips are in countries with great beaches? You know, Costa Rica, boy, you know, they've been... I likewise, I remember hearing about one, I think it was a school or a clinic that got repainted 8 different times over the course of one summer by successive groups. But... You know, having said that, look, what Americans can bring to another country, it's not labor. You know, there's plenty of labor in the developing world as it is. But there are plenty of people who do have real skills. And one of those skills that just about every American has is fluent English. And the ability to teach English is a really valued skill in much of the world. So I think that there are ways in which Americans can go and actually be useful in the rest of the world. And, you know, probably the usefulness in that locality is not as nearly as much as the cost of the plane fare and all that. But I do think there's also something to be said for building a constituency of Americans who have actually spent some time abroad, who, when they think about, Paraguay, they actually can conjure a real image of real people, what a real village looks like. And then these issues become a little bit more real to them. And so I think that if one is humble enough to acknowledge that the biggest beneficiary of those trips is oneself, not those people one is nominally helping, then I think it really can be useful. And that's just broadly true that, you know, at the end of the day, our efforts to help others have a somewhat mixed record of success, but they have this almost perfect record of helping ourselves.
How do you make the decision when you're writing an article to focus on the individual and empathy rather than the system that's caused the problem? And I'm specifically was moved by your the child who was deaf. We've had in this country since 1972 early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. West Virginia, or Virginia, wherever he's from, has this program. But your article looked at him, and we all, you know, moved our heartstrings rather than the government that is getting federal money to make sure that the hundreds of kids or thousands of kids like him, and your article sort of perpetuates that.
Well, I would argue that it's that by focusing on an individual, one creates some accountability for the system. But really, the reason why I ended up writing so much about individuals, it dates back to Darfur. And again, I was writing about the slaughter there, and it felt as if my columns were just, you know, disappearing. And then at that same time, I don't know if any of you remember, but this is 2004, and in New York, in Central Park, there were two hawks. Two red-tailed hawks, pale male. You remember this? Pale male. They were kicked out of their nest in an apartment building, and all New York was just up in arms about these two homeless hawks. And I thought, how is it that I can't generate as much outrage about hundreds of thousands of people being killed as New Yorkers feel about two homeless hawks? And that led me to the work on kind of what makes us care, what engages us a number of people have done it, but a guy called Paul Slovic has done the most research on this. And it turns out that it's essentially two different things that are rather counterintuitive and exactly the opposite way from how journalists and humanitarians normally raise these issues. And the first is that it's about individual stories and emotional stories that will open that pathway. And if you ask people to do math problems first, to kind of prime the brain to think in a more rational way, and then ask them to donate, they will donate substantially less. That it's an emotional process. Likewise, that we all know at some level that if you ask people to support a class of people that were less moved, but the point at which numbers reduce empathy is when when the number of victims rises from 1 to 2. The moment there's even a second person in the story, then we become less inclined to contribute. And the other lesson is that people want some sense that there is a chance of a positive arc in the story. If they just hear how awful things are, how dreadful the needs are, and there's no sense that things can be better, then they just tune out. And so it creates all kinds of problems because you don't want to write just about Johnny. There are all kinds of people who need broad screenings, and not just for hearing, but all kinds of other screenings as well. But I think that if one wants to engage the public and create momentum to move, then we have to think more about the messaging and the storytelling. We meaning journalists, we meaning aid groups, humanitarians, and I think it has to be more about talent, finding really compelling stories that will move people, that will wake up that sense of empathy, and then also show that however dreadful the stories are, that there can be better outcomes. And I think that if we do a better job of that, then I think we can build those pathways, create a little bit more compassion, reduce the empathy deficit, and, you know, build a better country and build a better world. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.